I spent the last month or so thinking about what I wanted to share with you today. And then I spent the last couple of weeks writing, and at some point I went to the river, a very wonderful wild river north of here. And as we were coming, looking down on the river, we saw, my daughter saw a snake on a rock, perfectly beautiful. And in the river, a salmon trying to go back home. He tried and he tried. I don't know if he ever made it yet. But apparently, they will keep trying until they get there, or they die, or they're caught. They're very beautiful, noble creatures. And all along I was thinking about what to talk about and to share with you today. And this is what it is. It's called, "This Was Not an Area of Large Plantations." Suffering too insignificant for the majority to see. This was not an area of large plantations. Not like in Gone with the Wind, you know. This was not an area of large plantations. Since the land is hilly with some bottoms of rich soil, some bottoms, mostly hilly. Whites usually had small or medium-sized farms with slaves. But one pervasive thread of, quote, Southern life ran through Leake County, Mississippi history. White masters raped black slave women who bore their children, as Winston Hudson tells in her own grandmother's story. The treatment of these children varied, and sometimes they were accepted or acknowledged as relatives by the white families. And other perversity was always looming. Percy Sanders, a descendant of an early black family in the area, recalled hearing as a child about George Slaughter, a white farmer's son by a black woman who came to a horrible death because, quote, he didn't keep his place. Ambushed by white men, including his own father, he was shot while riding his horse because the saddle horse was, quote, too fine. He was shot while riding his horse because the saddle horse was too fine. The story goes that when he was found, George was found, the horse was drinking his blood. This is from Mississippi Harmony, Memoirs of a Freedom Fighter, by Winston Hudson and Constance Curry, forward by Derek Bell, 2002. When I went to live in Mississippi in the 60s and to work in the civil rights movement, whose aim was to emancipate and empower African Americans who were still in their thousands treated as bad and sometimes worse than slaves, I met Winston Hudson. She was trying to write the story of her life. I helped her until I left Mississippi to live in New England. We sat under a tree and I wrote what she dictated. Today her story has become a book that will be available in a few months. I begin my talk with this harrowing quote, harrowing, simply to ground us all in the reality of being African Americans, African Indians, African Amerindians. We are that mixture of peoples brought together very often and for centuries in the most intense racial confusion, hatred, and violence. This horrible story, which has haunted me since I read it, is typical of the kind of psychic assault we endure, while it is exactly the kind of assault today's white majority takes no notice of, just as it took no notice 2 and 3 and 100 years ago. This story, so chilling. The horse was drinking his blood. His own father was one of his assassins. His crime was that his horse was too fine. Unfortunately, this story is one in a storehouse of stories those of us present might hear or expect to hear on any given day of our lives. What do we do with the shock? What do we do with the anger, the rage? What do we do with the pain? When I read this story last month, I was sitting in a federal courthouse, preparing to do jury duty. I felt ill immediately, but not as ill as I would feel an hour later upon entering the courtroom, when I was confronted with the fact that 3 young men of color, 1 Asian, 2 Latino, were to be tried for the murder of a policeman whom they allegedly killed when he interrupted their burglary of a steakhouse. One glance at the accused trio revealed the faces of malnourished children, barely out of their teens. The choice before the jury would be life imprisonment without parole, or the death penalty. The judge, white and middle class, well-fed and well-educated, seemed prepared to impose either choice. Here were the modern brothers of George Slaughter. My first version of this talk began with a poem by Basho. Sitting quietly, doing nothing, spring comes, and the grass grows by itself. Sitting quietly, doing nothing, spring comes, and the grass grows by itself. I was thinking of how I found my way from the backwoods of Georgia as a young woman into the company of the finest poets. It was a route of unbelievable, serious magic. As a child, my family had no money to buy books, though all of us loved to read. Because I was injured as a child, and blinded in one eye. The state gave me a stipend, which meant I could buy all the books I wanted. When I went north to college, my first stop after settling in my room was the bookstore, where I entered a state of ecstasy, seeing before me all the books of poetry I was literally dying to read. It was there in the Sarah Lawrence College bookstore that I encountered Basho and Busan and Issa, Japanese Buddhist haiku poets who'd lived centuries before, and also a book called Zen Telegrams by Paul Reps. We connected on the profound level of nature. That is to say, in these poets, I discovered a kindred sensibility that respected nature itself as profound, magical, creative, and intelligent. There was no hint, as in other poetry, that simply because he was able to write about nature, man was somehow therefore superior to it. So this is how I was going to begin. But then I thought, it's more honest to start with the hard stuff, the stuff that makes addicts and slaves of Africans, 150 years after the Emancipation Proclamation. For I knew while sitting in that courtroom, having read the story of George Slaughter and acknowledging the young men before me as today's version of George Slaughter, that the pain I was feeling is the same pain that sends our people reeling into the streets and alleys, looking for a fix to fix all that is wrong with this gruesome picture. It is the pain that undermines our every attempt to relieve ourselves of external and internalized white domination. The pain that murders our every wish to be free. It is a pain that seems unrelenting, a pain that seems to have no stopping and no end, a pain that is ultimately insidiously turning a generous, life-loving people into a people who no longer feel empathy for the world. We need only listen to African-American comedians to see that our traditional compassion for life has turned into the most egregious cynicism. We are being consumed by our suffering. We are a people who have always loved life and loved the earth. We have been people who actually noticed the earth, how responsive and alive it is. We have appreciated it. We've been a nation of creators and farmers who adored the earth even when we were not permitted to own any part of it larger than our graves. And then only until a highway needed to be built or a condominium constructed on top of them. I remember distinctly the joy I witnessed on the faces of my parents, my grandparents, as they savored the sweet odor of spring soil or the fresh liveliness of wind. This compassionate, generous, life-affirming nature of ours that can be heard in so much of our music is our Buddha nature. It is how we innately, intrinsically are. It is too precious to lose, even to disappointment and grief. looking about at the wreck and ruin of America, which all our forced, unpaid labor over five centuries was unable to avert. We cannot help wanting our people who have suffered so grievously and held the faith so long to at last experience lives of freedom and lives of joy. And so those of us chosen by life to blaze different trails than the ones forced on our ancestors have explored the known universe in search of that which brings the most peace, self-acceptance, and liberation. We have found much to inspire us in nature, in the sheer persistence and wonder of creation itself, much in indigenous wisdom, much in the popular struggles for liberation around the world, notably in Cuba, where the people demonstrate a generosity of spirit and an understanding and love of humankind that, given their isolation and oppression by our country, is almost incomprehensible. We have been strengthened by the inevitable rise of the feminine, brought forward so brilliantly by women's insistence in our own time, and of course by our own African-American struggle for dignity and freedom, which has inspired the world. In addition, many of us have discovered in the teachings of the Buddha wise, true, beautiful guidance on the treacherous path life and history set us upon. Having said this, let me emphasize that I did not come to the study and practice of Buddhism to become a Buddhist. In fact, I am not. I am not a Buddhist. And Buddha would not have minded this in the least. He would have been happy to hear it. He was not himself a Buddhist. He was the thing itself, an enlightened being, just as Jesus Christ was not a Christian, but a Christ, an enlightened being. The challenge to me is not to be a follower of something, but to embody it. I am willing to try for that. And this is how I understand the meaning of both Jesus and Buddha. When the Buddha, dying, entreated his followers to, quote, be a lamp unto yourself, I understood he was willing to free his followers even from his own teachings. He had done all he could do, taught them everything he had learned. Now their own enlightenment was up to them. He was also warning them not to claim him as the sole route to their salvation, thereby robbing themselves of responsibility for their own choices, behavior, and lives. I came to meditation after a particularly painful divorce. Painful because I never ceased to care for the man I divorced. I married him because he was one of the best people I'd ever encountered, and that remained true. However, life had other plans for us both. I left my home as Buddha left his 2,500 years ago, to see if I could discover how I at least could be happy. If I could be happy in a land where torture of my kind was commonplace, then perhaps there was a general happiness to be found. The person who taught me transcendental meditation was teaching out of the Hindu tradition and never mentioned the Buddha, the Four Noble Truths about the fact of human suffering, its causes, the necessity to engage, endure, and transform it, or the Eightfold Path, which provides a guide to moral conscious living. What she did teach me was the deeper value of sitting quietly, doing nothing, breathing. This took me back to childhood days when I did this without thinking. Days when I was aware I was not separate from the cosmos. Days when I was happy. This was actually a place where poets, time out of mind, have frequently lived. No wonder I felt at home there. And so I laughed. The laughter bubbled up, irrepressible. I saw the path to happiness and to liberation at a glance. It was inside myself. Now I understand that all great teachers love us. This is essentially what makes them great. I also understand that it is this love that never dies, and that having once experienced it, we have the confidence always exhibited by well-loved humans to continue extending the same love. Buddha, presumably a Hindu, was no doubt disheartened by its racism, that is to say, the caste system that today blights the lives of 160 million Indians. Indians who were once called untouchables and now call themselves Dalits, or those broken to pieces. They are not allowed to own land. They cannot enter the same doors, attend the same schools, or drink from the same wells as the so-called higher castes. Their shadow must never fall on those above them. They are brutalized and the women raped at will. Niggers of India, they are. Traditionally, it is taught that the Buddha discovered someone old, someone sick, and someone dying after having lived a very sheltered and indulged life, and that because of this suffering inherent to all mankind, he struck out into the world to find a remedy. There's no mention, usually, of the horrible caste system everywhere in place in his area, which I personally find it impossible to imagine the Buddha ignoring. I like to think of the young prince Siddhartha observing this hypocrisy of his native religion, perhaps touching or loving an untouchable, and deciding there had to be a better way, a higher truth. I like to think of him leaving his cushy home and delightful family, his loving wife and adorable son, and striking out into the wilderness, searching for a way humans could rid themselves of the hideous affliction of spirit that forced division and degradation a part of the human family imposes. Which is to say, I felt Buddha's spirit long before I began to study his words. I felt him not as a god or as the son of a god, but as a human being who looked around, as any of us might do, and said to himself, something here is really wrong. People are such beautiful and wondrous creations. Why are they being tortured? What have they done that this should be so? How can there be an end to their suffering? The Buddha sat down. Most of the representations of the Buddha show him sitting down. Sometimes he's lying down. Sometimes he is walking, though this is rare. Sometimes he is shown leaping to his feet and flinging up his arms in joy. Anyone who meditates recognizes these states. First, the sitting, the concentration on the breath, sometimes the lying down, feeling our connection to the mother, the great support of earth. There is the walking, which integrates our bodies with our mind state. Then there is the feeling of exuberance when we realize we've freed ourselves again. How does this happen? I imagine there are people who turn to Buddha because they've lost a lot of money. I imagine this. My experience, however, is that almost everyone I've met that has turned to Buddha did so because they have suffered the end of a love affair. They have lost someone they loved. Perhaps they have lost a country as well, or parents, or siblings, or some function of their bodies. But very often, people turn to the Buddha because they have been carried so deeply into their suffering by the loss of a loved one that without major help, they fear they will never recover. I actually love this about Buddhists, that though their reputation is all about suffering and meditating and being a bit low-key sexually and spiritually languid, they are in fact a band of hopeful lovers who risk their hearts in places a Methodist would rarely dare to tread. This is what happened to me. I had lost my own beloved. The pain of this experience seemed bottomless and endless. Enter my teacher for that moment of my life, the Buddhist nun Pema Chodron, and her teachings on a set of tapes called Awakening Compassion. Under her guidance, far in the country, away from everyone, on my own retreat of one, I learned an ancient Tibetan Buddhist meditation practice called Tonglen, along with the teachings that accompanied it, called Lojong. This involved, during meditation, learning to breathe in the pain I was feeling, not to attempt to avoid it or flee it. It involved making my heart bigger and bigger just to be able to hold it all. It involved breathing out relief and happiness for everyone on earth who was feeling as miserable as I was. I stayed at this practice for 1 year. It worked. So that today, sometimes I wonder what my suffering over the loss of a loved one was really about. And I have almost concluded that it was again the love of the Buddha, reaching through 2,500 years, wanting me to understand I had some control over how much suffering I endure, wanting me to try a remedy he had found and to see for myself whether it works. My novel, The Color Purple, was actually my Buddha novel without Buddhism. In the face of unbearable suffering, following particularly the assassinations and betrayals of the civil rights movement, I too sat down upon the earth and asked it its permission to posit a different way from that in which I was raised. Just as the Buddha did when Mara, the king of delusion, asked what gave him the right to think he could direct humankind away from the suffering they had always endured. When Mara queried him, the Buddha touched the earth. This is the single most important act, to my mind, of the Buddha, because it acknowledges where he came from. It is a humble recognition of his true heritage, his true lineage. Though Buddhist monks would spend millennia pretending all wisdom evolves from the masculine, and would consequently treat Buddhist nuns abominably, Buddha clearly placed himself in the lap of the Earth Mother and affirmed her wisdom and her support. It has been enormously helpful to me to learn that Buddha's wife and son eventually joined him in the wilderness, and that she became both a follower and a teacher. There was love between them, for sure. How I wish we had a record of some of her thoughts. The male effort to separate wisdom from the realm of the feminine is not only brutal and unattractive, but it will always fail. Though this may take, as with Buddhism, thousands of years. It will fail because the feminine is wisdom, and it is also the soul. Since each and every person is born with an internal as well as an eternal feminine, just as everyone is born with an internal and eternal masculine, this is not a problem, except for those who insist on forcing humans into gender roles, which makes it so much easier for them to be controlled. Sometimes, as African Americans, African Indians, African Amerindians, people of color, it appears we are being removed from the planet. Fascism and Nazism, visibly on the rise in the world, has always been our experience of white supremacy in America, and this has barely let up. Plagues such as AIDS seem incredibly convenient for the forces that have enslaved and abused us over the centuries, and who today are as blatant in their attempts to seize our native homelands as Columbus was 500 years ago. Following the suffering and exhilaration of the 60s, a pharmacopoeia of drugs suddenly appeared, just as we were becoming used to enjoying our own minds. Citizen television, which keeps relentless watch over each and every home, claims the uniqueness and individuality of the majority of our children from birth. After the assassinations of Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X, Che Guevara, and so many other defenders of humanity, known and unknown, around the globe, we find ourselves in the year 2002, with an unelected president who came to office by disenfranchising black voters, just as was done routinely before Martin Luther King Jr. and the rest of us were born. This is a major suffering for black people, and we must not overlook it. I myself, on realizing what had happened, felt a soul sickness I had not experienced in decades. Those who wanted power beyond anything else, oil and the money to be made from oil, which is the Earth Mother's blood, were contemptuous of the sacrifices generations of our ancestors made. The suffering of our people, especially of our children, with their bright, hopeful eyes, is of no significance to them. George Slaughter. The surname would have been his master father's, and deadly accurate. George Slaughter was not killed. We intuit this. He was not killed because his saddle horse was too fine. George was killed because he was too fine. That is the bind that we're in. There is a private joke I have with myself. The question is, why did Europeans enslave us in Africa and take us to the United States? The answer: because we would not go voluntarily. The African Americans who are abetting the rape and pillage of Earth, helping literally to direct the bombs that fall on the innocent, and let us affirm the innocent and the exquisite, are still another cause of our suffering. We look into their eyes and experience a great fright. They appear so familiar, and yet somehow we feel they are not. I do not call their names, because essentially they are, as we are, energies. And they are familiar to us because they have been around just as long as we have. This poem, which I think of as one of my bitter poems, expresses something of their position when they can bear to acknowledge it throughout the long centuries. They may not have been on the Supreme Court. They may not have been in the cabinet. They may not have been flying Air Force One, but they were around. They helped their own, and this is from the perspective of them, looking at the people they have helped, seeing that those people helped their own. They helped their own. They did not help us. We helped them help themselves. Beggars that we are. Underneath what is sometimes glibly labeled racism or sexism or casteism, there lurks covetousness, envy, and greed, all human states that can be, through practice, worked on, worked with, and transformed. This is the good news for our oppressors, as it is for humans generally, since we all have these qualities to a degree. The equally good news for us is that we can turn our attention away from our oppressors, unless they are directly endangering us to our face, and work on the issue of our suffering without attaching them to it. The teaching that supports this idea is this: Suppose someone shot you with an arrow, right in the heart. Would you spend your time screaming at the archer, or even trying to locate him? Or would you try to pull the arrow out of your heart? White racism, that is to say, envy, covetousness, and greed, incredible sloth and laziness in the case of enslaving others to work for you, is the arrow that has pierced our collective heart. For centuries, we have tried to get the white archer even to notice where his arrow has landed, to connect himself, even for a moment, to what he's done. Maybe even to consider apologizing, which he hates to do, to make reparations, to repair, make reparations, repair, to make reparations which he considers absurd. This teaching says enough. Screaming at the archer is a sure way to remain attached to your suffering rather than easing or eliminating it. A better way is to learn through meditation, through study and practice, a way to free yourself from the pain of being shot, no matter who the archer is. There is also the incredibly useful assurance that everything is change. Everything is impermanent. The country is impermanent. The laws, impermanent. The fascists, perennial, but impermanent. The Nazis, the archer and the arrow. Our lives, their lives, life. Looking about at the wreckage, looking about at the wreckage. The wreckage. It is clear that it's clear to all that in enslaving us and oppressing us, trying to get ahead on the basis of our misery, our oppressors in the past had no idea what they were doing. They still don't. As we practice, let this thought deeply, deeply, deeply root. From this perspective, our compassion for their ignorance seems the only just tribute, the only just tribute to our survival. Who or what knows what is really going on around here anyway? Only the Tao, only life, only creation, or only that which is beyond human expression. Sitting quietly, doing nothing. Spring comes, and the grass grows by itself. This place of peace, of serenity, and gratitude does exist. It is available to all. In a way, this place of quiet and peacefulness could be said to be our shadow, our deserved shadow, our African Amerindian shadow. In European thought, the shadow is rarely understood as positive because it is dark, because it is behind us, and because we cannot see it. But for us, ultra-sensitive to the blinding glare of racism and suffering daily the searing effects of incomprehensible behavior, our shadow of peace that we so rarely see, our shadow of peace, our shadow of peace that we so rarely see, can be thought of as welcoming shade, the shade of an internal tree, a tree that grows beside our internal river and bathes us in peace. Meditation is the path that leads to this internal glade. To share that certainty is the greatest privilege and joy. I am grateful for the opportunity to join you in this first ever African-American Buddhist retreat in North America. Although, as I have said, I am not a Buddhist, I have found a support in the teachings of the Buddha that is beyond measure, as I have found comfort and support in those teachings I have received from ancient Africans and indigenous people of my own continent and from the earth itself. The teacher who has been most helpful to me, in addition to Pema Chodron, is Jack Kornfield, an extraordinary guide and human being whose books and tapes, among them A Path with Heart, After the Ecstasy, The Laundry, and The Roots of Buddhist Psychology, I would recommend to anyone who seeks a better understanding of the inspirited life. Sharon Salzberg's book, Loving Kindness, The Revolutionary Art of Happiness, has been an incomparable gift. Recently, in a book called Knee Deep in Grace, I discovered the teachings of the Indian female yogi, householder and mother, Deepama. Her instructions and observations seem endlessly potent. I am deeply grateful to all the teachers who came before these four that I have mentioned, teachers from Vietnam, Thich Nhat Hanh, for instance, Thailand, Burma, India, and especially Tibet. I thank the Dalai Lama for allowing himself to be a symbol of good in a world that seems at times hopelessly tilted toward evil. I thank Martin Luther King Jr. for the warm, brotherly touch of his hand when I was young and seeking a way to live with dignity in my native land, and for the sound of his voice, which was so full of our experience. I thank him for loving us all so very much. If he had been able to live and teach as the Buddha did until the age of 80, how different our world would be. It is such a gift to have his books and recordings of his words and to be able to understand his death as a teaching on both the preciousness of human existence and impermanence. And as always, I thank the ancestors, those who have gone on and those who are always arriving. It is because our global spiritual ancestors have loved us very dearly that we sit together practicing ways to embody peace and create a better world. I feel personally ever bathed in that love. Now I would like us to sit. This is for George. Take a deep breath. Let it out. Relax your neck. Relax your shoulders. They've carried a lot. It's time to put it down. Let us bring our attention to the life of our young brother, our ancestor, George Slaughter. We know he was a beautiful young man, and that it was this beauty and his freedom expressing it that caused his father, himself unfree, to seek his death. We can see George. We can see George sitting on his stunning saddle horse. We do not know if his half-sister, White, confused that she liked this darker person, gave it to him. We do not know if his mother, black and irresistible, as so many black women are, gave it to him. We do not know if he bought it himself. All we know is that he is sitting there, happy. And the horse, too, is happy. George Slaughter, an English name. We might think of Bob Marley, half English, with his English name. Perhaps George Slaughter had a similar spirit, a kindred look and attitude. May you be free, George. May you be free. May you be happy, George. May you be at peace. May you be at rest. May you know we remember you. Let's breathe. Let us bring our attention now to George's mother. We know she came and picked up the pieces, which is what Black mothers have done so long. Mother, may you be free. May you be happy. May you be at peace. May you be at rest. May we know that we remember you. Let us bring our attention to George's father. He who trails the murder of his lovely boy throughout whatever remains of time. Father, may you be free. May you be happy. May you be at peace. May you be at rest. May you know that we remember you. Let us bring our attention to those who rode with the Father, whose silence and whose violence caused so much suffering that continues in the world today. May you be free. May you be happy. May you be at peace. May you be at rest. May you know that we remember you. And now let us bring our attention to George's horse, who drank his blood in grief over the horror of his companion's death. We know by now that the other animals on the planet watch us and know us, and sometimes they love us. How they express that love is sometimes mysterious. Beautiful horse, fine horse, big black eyes. May you be free. May you be happy. May you be at peace. May you be at rest. May you know that we remember you. I love the study and practice of Buddhism because it is good medicine for healing us so that we may engage the work of healing the ancestors. Ancestors like George, ancestors like George's father. Both George and his father are ancestors. What heals ancestors is understanding them. That is what heals ancestors. And understanding as well that it is not in heaven or in hell that the ancestors are healed. Not in heaven, not in hell, that the ancestors are healed. They can only be healed inside of us. Buddhist practice sent by ancestors we didn't even know we had is just in time.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.